So someone took the trouble to write it on the board, so I'm going to chant it, and I'll ask a couple of other people to chant it. I mean, I don't really know how to... I know a little something about Sanskrit pronunciation, if it's written in the... what do you call this? The phonetic form. Atachaduhitaram prajapatir vishvakarmana upayeme bahishmatim nama tasyam uhavava atmajan atmasamana shilaguna karma rupa viyodaran dasha bhavayam bhabhuva kanyam shayavi yasim ujasvatim nama. Okay, we won't do the word for word just for the sake of trying to save some time because it's already a little bit late. Thereafter, Maharaj Priyavrata married Bahishmati, the daughter of the Prajapati named Vishvakarma. Well, you know that's the demigod who makes everything that's him. Eh? In her, he begot 10 sons equal to him in beauty, character, magnanimity, and other qualities. He also begot a daughter, the youngest of all, named Urjasvati. Thereafter, Maharaj Priyavrata married Bahishmati, the daughter of the Prajapati named Vishvakarma. In her he begot 10 sons, equal to him in beauty, character, magnanimity, and other qualities. He also begot a daughter, the youngest of all, named Urjasvati. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Maharaj Priyavrata not only carried out the order of Lord Brahma by accepting the duties of government, but also married Bahishmati, the daughter of Vishvakarma, one of the Prajapatis. Since Maharaj Priyavrata was fully trained in transcendental knowledge, he could have returned home and conducted the business of government as a brahmachari. Instead, however, when he returned to household life, he accepted a wife also. The principle is that when one becomes a grihastha, he must live perfectly in that order, which means he must live peacefully with a wife and children. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's first wife died, his mother requested him to marry for a second time. He was 20 years old and was going to take sannyas at the age of 24, yet, by the request of his mother, he married. As long as I'm in householder life, he told his mother, I must have a wife, for household life does not mean staying in a house. Real household life means living in a house with a wife. There's even a song like that. Yeah, a house, well, a house without love is not a home. Love means wife, right? Three words in this verse are very significant. Uha vava. These words are used to express wonder. Priyavrata Maharaj had taken a vow of renunciation, but accepting a wife and begetting children have nothing to do with the path of renunciation. These are activities on the path of enjoyment. It was a source of great wonder, therefore, that Priyavrata Maharaj, who had followed the path of renunciation, had now accepted the path of enjoyment. Prabhupada's talking about himself. Sometimes we are criticized because although I am a sannyasi, I have taken part in the marriage ceremonies of my disciples. It must be explained, however, that since we have started a Krishna-conscious society, and since a human society must also have ideal marriages, to correctly establish an ideal society, we must take part in marrying some of its members, although we have taken to the path of renunciation. This may be astonishing to persons who are not very interested in establishing Daiva Varnashrama, the transcendental system of 4 social orders and 4 spiritual orders. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, however, wanted to reestablish Daiva Varna Ashram. In Daiva Varna Ashram, There cannot be acknowledgement of social status according to birthright, because in Bhagavad Gita it is said that the determining considerations are guna and karma, one's qualities and work. It is this Daiva Varna Ashrama that should be established all over the world to continue a perfect society for Krishna consciousness. This may be astonishing to foolish critics, but it is one of the functions of a Krishna conscious society. Om Gyanatimirandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshurunmalitam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master is forcing open my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. Vanchakalpa tarupyascha kripa sindubhyo evacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivashadi Gaura Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I must confess that I got a late notice for giving this class, so it may not be as organized as I would like, or maybe as you would like it to be, but let's hope we can churn up some ideas for meditating on and for giving us some nourishment today in our practice of Krishna consciousness, our doing our service. So we have also some examples in our movement of devotees who got married more out of duty than out of personal desire. Gauravinda Maharaj was one such devotee. He didn't want to get married. He was very renounced. But if I remember correctly, he was the oldest son, and the mother was a widow. So he really felt he had to comply to his mother's desire. And he did it very thoroughly, even to the point where at one point he needed to upgrade. He was a teacher, but in order to make more money, he had seven children. And of course, in an Indian family, you don't only have seven children, right? You have a few other dependents that you take responsibility for. So he had a few of those too. And so in order to upgrade his teacher's certificate, he studied for 1 month non-stop, which means he stopped his sadhana, he stopped everything, so that he could do it rather in 1 month, I believe, than in 1 year. And he did it. So he was such an exalted devotee, but still, when his mother requested him to take to household life, he did it, and he did it in an ideal manner. He took full responsibility. He maintained his family very responsibly, and of course he did everything he could to educate them in spiritual life. So this idea that Maharaj Priyavrata, he could have just been a brahmachari grihastha, so to speak, a king. We know that Maharaj Bharat, when Ramchandra went to the forest, he lived like practically like a brahmachari. He just put Ramachandra's shoes on the throne, and he himself lived in a hut. And as this detail that you told me, I mean, I think I heard it, but it was when you told me, it was quite that he said, "If you don't get back here if one day late, and I won't be here." Whew. So he was very determined to live in that way. So we might wonder why Maharaj Priyavrata didn't do the same thing. Even in ISKCON sometimes we're very surprised when we see very advanced devotees take to household life, and quite happily. We have an example in our midst here, right? Radhakumand got married. He's a very good householder. He was an ideal brahmachari. We should know that also that healthy brahmacharis make good grihasthas, and especially if they have a qualified wife, they have a qualified partner, a life's partner, then all the good qualities that developed in their training as brahmacharis can be very well utilized in household life. And indeed, that's an ideal household life when both partners are fully trained and actually following orders, taking shelter of authority and following orders, coming together as healthy, full-developed individuals and trying to pool their resources in order to advance in devotional service and advance the Sankirtan movement. Prabhupada mentions here that he was criticized for his taking to giving marriage or overseeing marriage ceremonies. Actually, Prabhupada was always very concerned and anxious that his grihastha devotees should live nicely, like gentlemen and ladies, and that especially that they raise Krishna-conscious children and set a good example. Of course, we also know the history is not as glorious as Prabhupada would have liked it. He was extremely disappointed, and sometimes he even was disgusted with some of his disciples because they couldn't do what he wanted them to do or what they should be doing in Krishna consciousness. They just didn't have the adhikar. And of course, Srila Prabhupada, he did adjust, but it wasn't easy for him to see that his disciples could not come up to the standard. He would also ask some of his disciples from India, please try to instruct my Western disciples so that they can do the thing properly. Of course, there were many more Western devotees than Indian devotees, so it was a big job. And we've had some serious history of failure in this regard. But in any case, we carry on because we try to take in stride. That's not surprising, considering our adhikar, our background, or our lack of adhikar, that we wouldn't have been immediately successful. And as far as this emphasis that Srila Prabhupada is putting on Varna Ashram Dharma, even devotees in ISKCON sometimes think, oh, they don't want to talk about this Varna Ashram Dharma. They think it's a redundant discussion, and they think that what's the use of discussing this? But we know, Shishu Radha Gopinath Ki Jai, that one of the last purports that Prabhupada wrote or that he dictated to be written in the Srimad Bhagavatam was concerning this. I took an excerpt from that. We've seen this when it's been videoed when Prabhupada is dictating this. Prabhupada is barely whispering, and Jayadutta Swami's got the microphone to his mouth, and Prajumna's also, everybody's crowded around Prabhupada's bed trying to hear what he's saying. So Prabhupada was saying, when the aim of life, namely realization of the absolute truth, is missed by too much attachment for indriya priti or sense gratification, as already discussed here and before, the institution of the Varna Ashram is utilized by selfish men to pose on, this is another excerpt. Don't mind, I'm a little jumbled here. By hearing and discussing Srimad Bhagavatam, the Rajoguna and Tamoguna are subdued, so that only Sattvaguna remains. Then Rajoguna and Tamoguna cannot do us any harm. Varnashram Dharma, therefore, is essential, for it can bring people to Sattvaguna, Tadarajas, Tamobhava, Kama Lobadeyas Chaye. Tamoguna and Rajoguna increase lust and greed, which implicate a living entity in such a way that he must exist in this material world in many, many forms. That is very dangerous. One should therefore be brought to Sattvaguna by the establishment of Varna Ashram Dharma and should develop the brahminical qualifications of being very neat and clean, rising early in the morning and seeing Mangal Arati, and so on. In this way, one should stay in Sattvaguna, and then one cannot be influenced by Tamaguna and Rajaguna. So Prabhupada was emphasizing Varna Ashram Dharma. Practically at the last breath, not because Varna Ashram is a goal, but it's a means for creating an atmosphere in which Sattvaguna can predominate, and in that atmosphere people become able to hear about Krishna and able to think about Krishna and talk about Krishna. And as I was reading before, this Daivivarnashram Dharma is also mentioned in many places, and in the first canto I was reading this this quote: when the aim of life, namely realization of the absolute truth, is missed by too much attachment for indriya priti or sense gratification, as already discussed herein before, the institution of the varnashram is utilized by selfish men to pose an artificial predominance over the weaker section. So that's the problem. Varnashram has not enjoyed a good reputation because of the vitiated form of it now that we have in India, the caste system, which is it's a very degraded form of varnashram dharma. In the Kali Yuga and the age of quarrel, this artificial predominance is already current. But the saner section of the people know it well, that the divisions of castes and orders of life are meant for smooth social intercourse and high-thinking self-realization and not for any other purpose. So this is actually the purpose of this Daivi Varnashram Dharma. And Prabhupada was very interested in and very much pushing that it should be established. I mean, recently a devotee asked me, or a devotee said quite sarcastically, that instead of thinking about Radha and Krishna's pastimes, people are pushing this Varnashram Dharma. And quite like, is there something wrong with our leaders? Why are they focusing so much on this? And I was thinking, is Varnashram Dharma and hearing about Radha and Krishna exclusive to each other? And of course, we know that Prabhupada said, first deserve and then desire. Prabhupada said that if you carry on the preaching, then you'll get the mercy of the previous acharyas. And they will reveal to you the esoteric nature of Radha Krishna's pastimes. Not that one has to artificially jump there. And that's why Prabhupada says here, this pushing to establish Varnashram Dharma may be astonishing to foolish critics, but it is one of the functions of the Krishna conscious society. As far as the idea that it's astonishing that a king, that a devotee would take to an opulent lifetime, a life, instead of maintaining his renunciation, in this case Priyavrata, who remembers some incidents from the Bhagavad Gita, or sorry, from the Bhagavatam, some verses from the Bhagavatam, where the idea of wealth is considered very dangerous? There's some classic verses there. In terms of spiritual life, yes, Krinkun, exactly. Who said it, Jadarani? Yeah, yeah. My Lord, your lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So this, the idea is not here so much that wealth in and of itself is dangerous, but if one is aspiring for it. This is, we covered this point in the Bhakti Vaibhava course, that it's not the wealth itself that's dangerous, but that if one desires it and one hankers for it, because by hankering for wealth and desiring to have wealth, then one can't hanker for Krishna. They don't go together. But at the same time, we do know that there are incidents in the Bhagavatam where wealth proved to be a big problem. There's some classic incidents, maybe someone can remember, where wealth was a very serious problem for persons who should be practicing spiritual life. Yeah. The classic example. They were so intoxicated by wealth, and Prabhupada mentions many reasons why wealth is a problem, that people who take wealth, who have too much wealth, they become very hard-hearted. They even engage in the slaughter of innocent animals. They indulge in wine and women. They can't receive sadhus in their home because when the sadhus come, first of all, their homes are usually quite heavily barricaded because they have so much wealth, they have to protect it, right? I mean, if you just take a walk here in around the Radhadesh, there's many nice homes, but there's many dogs too. Our signs, what does it say? Ik bin here. What does it say on there? Ik woon hier. How did... What does that mean? Yeah, yeah. So, and it's nasty because these dogs, even if you're just walking on the road, they come and they bark at you. So people, when they have wealth, they become nervous, they become hard-hearted, they can't receive the sadhus in their home. Prabhupada was saying, one time Prabhupada was walking in India, and he accidentally, they crossed some farmer's land, and the farmer came out and he was bowing down and saying, "We're so blessed that you walked on our land." And Prabhupada commented, he said, if this was in America, they would shoot you for trespassing. There's even this one devotee, maybe some of you have seen it, sometimes you get these links and there's a sign that says, "Trespassers will be shot, survivors will be shot again." So this is what wealth does to people, makes them fearful, makes them hard-hearted. So at the same time, even in our history of the world, we have the example of Marie Antoinette. Marie Antoinette was a very wealthy queen in France, and she was so out of touch with the suffering of the people. People were starving in France, and the report came to the queen that people are starving because they have no bread. Who remembers what she said? "Yeah, let them eat cake." So she was so out of touch, but because she was so intoxicated by her own wealth, that she couldn't even understand that her people were starving. So what was her destination? Huh? Yeah. The same guillotine that she had used to cut off the heads of so-called offenders was used to cut off her head. It happened also in the Bhagavatam, right? To Daksha. In any case, the dangers are very real. But let's look a little bit now at the heroes of the Bhagavat. The heroes in the Bhagavat are kings. This is considered very extraordinary by scholars, right? Then they say normally in the history of the Vedas and Indian texts, the heroes are usually great sages and renunciants who renounced everything for the world. But in the Bhagavat, not only the Kshatriyas, but also the Vaishyas, the Gopis are the greatest heroes. This is quite extraordinary. But in any case, so we know of kings. The kings that are mentioned in the Bhagavad, they have so much wealth. So, any thoughts on that? Why they had so much? I mean, I have some ideas. I was trying to churn it up a little bit. What was the advantage of them having so much wealth, and or why did they have so much wealth? Yes, Prabhu? Pardon me, Prabhu? Okay, so because they were very pious, they had wealth. Yes, that's one of the results of piety. Okay. Any other ideas? They were having exactly that. Yes, they used wealth at that time. Yajnas were being performed in great opulence to please the Lord. Yes, wealth was used for yajnas. Sukumar, you have somebody? Varikman Prabhu? Yes, yes. The citizens. It wasn't that the king considered it his wealth. That wealth was being used to maintain the citizens, especially the brahmanas. And during times of emergency, during famines, like drought, war, the king would make sure that everybody was well taken care of. So he wasn't thinking it's my wealth. Some other points here. Yes, Prabhupada says that the way to use everything in Krishna's service, that rests with the men of knowledge. They had knowledge. They knew how to use everything in Krishna's service. They were Rajarshi, so they were qualified to have the wealth because they knew how to engage it in Krishna's service. And in the case of these kings, they also knew that they weren't going to stay in this condition for their whole life. They knew that at a certain point, it was finished for them, that they had to go off to the forest and actually become very accept a vow of poverty and live in a very austere way so that they could reach the goal of life. And in the case of Maharaj Priyavrata, he was very much protected because he had the blessings of his spiritual master, of his exalted grandfather, Lord Brahma. So even though he did take the part and he played the part of a king perfectly, he didn't do anything artificial. He didn't do anything that other people couldn't take an example from. Because most people, if they have wealth, if they're a king, they're not going to live like a brahmachari. You can't expect that. So he showed how to live with wealth in a way that was progressive. So in that sense, his wealth was not an obstacle. Of course, it is amazing that someone can live with so much wealth without becoming degraded. It's very wonderful. Even in the Christian tradition, it is said that it's easier for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. Or it's more difficult for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to enter through the eye of a needle. Have you heard that before? So everyone knows that wealth can be a great stumbling block for spiritual life. So it is truly amazing when a person can live with wealth. It's more easy to be renounced if you have nothing, but if you have everything and still you remain Krishna conscious, that's Prabhupada, of course, is the supreme example. Prabhupada was destined to be a wealthy man, but Krishna didn't let that wealth come until Prabhupada was pushing on the Krishna consciousness movement. And Prabhupada was amazing. Prabhupada was born and raised in Calcutta, but he was a city boy, actually. He used to say that about himself. But he was most comfortable when he was out in the country. Even like Radhanath Maharaj tells the story that when Prabhupada was first coming to New Vrindavan, there was only one flush toilet on the whole property. And Radhanath Maharaj had to stay up the whole night because it didn't work. But finally, just as Prabhupada was walking in the door, he got the toilet somehow miraculously to work. He didn't know, he wasn't a plumber. So what he did, he stayed up the whole night, and finally he got it to work. But when it came time for Prabhupada to do his ablutions, he just took his lota and went into the forest. So Prabhupada had all wealth and had so many people who were willing to do anything for him, but he was never attached. So this is amazing. It is really amazing, and we should be impressed. And then to be able to give that up and just go into the forest and live austerely for the rest of one's life. Prabhupada was giving the example that during the time of Gandhi, there were some rich men that they gave everything to Gandhi, but they died shortly thereafter because they couldn't tolerate the difference. It was too much for them. So it seems that the narrator of the Bhagavatam has a real reason to think that it's a very wonderful thing. And we should also be impressed. And we shouldn't try to imitate, but we should try with whatever resources that come our way to remember that whatever we have, it's not ours, and whatever we have is meant to be used in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada says not a farthing should be used for sense gratification. Anyways, thank you so much for listening patiently. If someone would like to make a comment, or what time is it now? Yes, comment or correction or realization question. If I can't answer it, I'll get Arudha Mataji or her illustrious son. Yes.
Just because you mentioned about Bharata and Ramayana. I was just listening to a class, and it was said that Lakshmi, he was. When after they went to the forest, and Bharat went to look for them to bring back Ram to rule the kingdom, Lakshmana, when he climbed the tree, when he saw him, he said he wanted to shoot an arrow to kill him because he thought that actually he wanted to come and kill Rama. And I got quite bewildered about that because not only Lakshmana, but so many other great personalities doubted about Bharat.
Doubted about?
About Bharat.
Yeah, Bharat, yeah.
So I was kind of like bewildered of why all these great personalities, being so great, didn't see the real situation, and instead they judged Bharat, especially like Lakshmana, who is, you know, Balaram. So can you...
Well, I can try to say a little something, and I'll ask others. Well, for me, the first thing that comes to my mind was the intensity of Bharat's love for Ram. It was so strong, and if he even got the hint that something, anything, anyone was trying to threaten Ram, his mood in that particular, as that particular avatar, was quite fiery. So that's, it's part of the Leela, it's part of the drama. Just like in this world, there's so much so-called drama going on, and everybody gets all caught up in it, it becomes a great adventure. That's not absent in the pastimes of the Lord. If you want drama, if you want misunderstanding and all kinds of lamentation and anger and fighting, you'll find it there, and it's transcendental. That's what comes to my mind. Maybe Arudha would like to say something more? So intense. We can hardly imagine the intensity of love. I'm not to speak about Bharat himself. He's not an ordinary soul. So his emotions are like Balaram. When Balaram would get angry, it was like the ocean on a full moon night. You know, very high tide on a full moon night. It's nothing to fool around with. So, of course, Ram was able to cut that anger down in a moment. He cut it down. He told Lakshman, if you want the kingdom, I'll tell Bharat and he'll give it to you. Immediately, he said, in a second he'll give it to you and he'll come with me. Of course, that was great, huh? That was really good. I mean, as far as the Leela is concerned, it's extremely relishable. Of course, Lakshman didn't care about the kingdom, but Ram had to get through to him, calm him down. So he had to cut him. Otherwise, he maybe not. He had to try to change the current of his anger. Not, you know, that. Hey, wait a minute. I'm not. You know what I mean? Did you have any thoughts?
Sacrifice to the Lord physically is one thing, but then for that sacrifice to not be recognized or to be misunderstood makes that an even greater sacrifice. And it shows a very powerful example for those of us who are aspiring to get that devotion, that, you know, sometimes in our service we may be doing something with the best intentions and yet still be misunderstood, and that's part of the sacrifice of doing the service. And so with Maharaj Bharata, that was sort of the nature of the service, that even though he was 100% dedicated to the Lord and ready to give up his whole life for him, and yet still he was misunderstood at times. And also we find that, like, in the story of Vali Maharaj in Vamanadeva, where Vali Maharaj he takes such a great risk by rejecting his spiritual master, by giving the three worlds to the Lord. And then after he does that, the Lord turns around and accuses him of not being true to his word and of trying to keep something away and of not living up to his family's reputation and all kinds of horrible things that you think, wow, how can the Lord say something like that? You know, he knows obviously his heart, he's given everything. And yet that adds to the full intensity of the surrender, because not only is the Lord taking everything away physically, but he's also destroying or are showing the world how there's not even a modicum of any sort of pride or self or anger in Balimhai, that he took that from the Lord and said, just put your foot on my head. And sometimes we see that element of misunderstanding has a role in Krishna's pastime, because it shows something quite intense to us.
Yes, I mean, the intensity of love is something it's here in this world, but even in Kali Yuga, it's not possible for people to have the kind of loving relationships that in bygone ages, like, there's very few women that will walk into fire. And apparently it was, like, it's said that it was normal, but I think even previously it wasn't normal, because when Archie walked into the fire, the demigods' wives were showering flowers. If it was an ordinary thing, they wouldn't shower flowers. So to be able to love to that extent where one's body, one's mind, everything is truly dedicated, and there's nothing that you want for yourself. The only thing you want is that person is pleased. It must be very sublime, of course, especially if that person is Krishna. And nothing less than that will satisfy the soul. We try to cling to something. I don't know. Just when I think about this, how many of you have seen the Little Krishna series? People might question how bona fide it is, but when the fire demon is getting pulled into Krishna's mouth, he's just like reaching for anything he can to keep from getting swallowed up by Krishna. And even like a burning branch, the last second you see his hand trying to grab the branch that he burned. I was thinking, that's like the false ego. False ego is like trying to grab at anything, because of the attachment for the material world, the attachment for the illusory fear that I won't get the shelter that Krishna promises. So, but when one loves Krishna, there's no question, the very love for Krishna is so intense that the only thing that the person becomes afraid of is being separated from Krishna, either by place or circumstances or by emotion. That's why a devotee is afraid of Maya, not because he's afraid of a very advanced devotee. He's afraid that my love for Krishna will diminish, or that my ability to love Krishna will diminish, because he experiences that in that love for Krishna is the perfection of his existence. And even, like you said, even if that means that Krishna himself, that's what Radharani says that, right? Even if he makes me brokenhearted by not being present before me, or he hands me roughly by his embrace. And we can expect that in this material world, we're going to be handled roughly. First of all, we should feel that we deserve it. And second of all, we should know that we're not going to be able to go back to Godhead without being tested. But of course, when the tests come, how many of us actually, at least initially, usually after some time, we get the message. If we don't get it, our friends help us to get it, that this is a necessary part of my development in spiritual life. But Balimar, he got it right away. Even his wife came out and got on his case. Yeah, he gets Krishna as his doorman. He can always see. Yeah, so these are the kind of role models that we have to meditate on and to pray to when we get in these difficult situations. We should remember Bharat. We should remember Bali Maharaj. And we should try to, even if we realize that we can't completely follow them, we should pray to them. And this will be very effective for helping us to get through all these so-called injustices that we may feel ourselves having to undergo as part of our purification. Yes, Jadarani?
Mm-hmm.
Krishna is misunderstood. Yeah, so we can think, someone was saying that recently. Oh yeah, Prahlad Nanda Maharaj was saying that someone went to Srila Prabhupada and said, nobody likes me, everybody's always criticizing me. And Prabhupada said, oh yeah, they did that to Lord Chaitanya also. And then the devotee was saying, no, but you don't understand. And Prabhupada said, no, they were always also criticizing Lord Chaitanya. Of course, we don't equate ourselves with Lord Chaitanya, but it's the principle. Actually, we should be surprised when we're not being criticized. And we should feel that I need to be criticized. That's, otherwise, how will I make advancement if I don't? I mean, remember the famous story of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati? This one man was criticizing Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati a lot. And then when he passed away, the devotees were happy. And Bhaktisiddhanta, he cried. And he said, actually, this man was my friend. Trinada Pisanichana, we're supposed to honor those who dishonor us. Don't ask me. I remember one time when I was on Harinam, on book distribution, some guy spit on me. He came up spitful on my face, and he just walked over, and I went, you dog. I was so upset. And Premasiri Prabhu, one time when he was trying to distribute a Krishna book, some man walked by, or some woman walked by, and spit on him. And Premasiri just went like this, and he was so absorbed in trying to sell the book that he didn't even really notice it so much. He just wanted this person to have the book. So you see, if you're actually very intensely absorbed in devotional service, someone can even spit on you and it's insignificant. Obviously, I wasn't having a good day that day. Somebody spit on me, I called him a dog. I know, I didn't pass that test. Anyway, thank you for bringing that up. That's a nice point. So let us not criticize devotees who are advanced in devotional service and who know how to utilize wealth in Krishna's service. And let us try to always practice humility in the different circumstances that we find ourselves in so that we can get the mercy of the Lord and the Vaishnavas. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaura Bhaktavinda ki jai.